Many years ago, I was invited by the, I think the Santa Clara County chapter of the American Atheist Society to appear as part of a panel that they were giving, a public program. As I say sometimes about great karmic mistakes we make, it seemed like a good idea at the time. So I said yes. I thought it would be entertaining or interesting. I don't know why I said yes, but I did. So I found myself at this event, sitting in front of this group, a fairly large group of people who all knew each other, know each other well. And there's a certain quality when people are together who feel they have a shared secret that makes them slightly superior to the average person. And there's a kind of ego-to-ego kind of jocularity in the room. This is not really particularly attractive, but it's very distinctive. So there were all these people who were all hailing each other across the room as fellow atheists, because it was a big gathering because the king of the atheists, the state president, was going to be a guest with us. And they also had a guest speaker who was a man who had consistently filed lawsuits to get In God We Trust off the money. I think that was it, and lawsuits against the Pledge of Allegiance and a few, you know, under God, a few things like that. He was himself an attorney, so he could just do this as a hobby because he didn't have to pay anyone, and he also had that same jocular folk hero kind of energy, and everybody was all real excited. I love the fact that there are these karmic groups all over the planet. Years ago, many years ago, before we ever moved here, David and I took a long lecture tour in the motorhome, a motorhome, and we ended up in Houston, Texas. We went from the Northwest to Houston, Texas. It was 3 months. It was totally fun. And when we finally finished in Houston, it was the home of NASA at that point, so we thought, this will be fun. So we went over to the NASA place to see the little space modules and the place where they all sat and all that stuff. It was very interesting. But the most impressive part of it was as soon as we stepped on the campus, which was very large, you could feel and see that same sort of jocular, we have a secret that makes us a little different energy that everybody was playing out, because this astral group of scientists who'd probably been training in the astral world for all these ideas to move us forward in Dwapara Yuga, and they'd all found each other, and they were hanging out at the NASA place in Houston, and they were putting people on the moon. It was no small thing. This was 30 years ago when the projects were still more dynamic, you know, more supported. And the atheists, of course, are united for a different cause, but they had that same deep sense of self-identity with their unique point of view. And their point of view, I have to say, just frankly and plainly made them very arrogant. It was a very arrogant vibration in the room of, we have the truth and the rest of you are deluded idiots. And the man who'd been filing the lawsuit was not somebody I would want to have dinner with. And the king of the atheists was very close to the incarnation of evil. He was like from Central Casting. He had dyed his hair extra black. He wore it really long. He just looked evil. I would try to find a nicer way to say it, but I can't. He really just seemed like a person who was delighting in destroying other things. He was evil in that sense. He seemed to find pleasure in dismantling that which gave other people hope. He would not have defined himself that way, but he was just plainly that way. So I found myself on this board here, and we were a group of religionists. I can't remember everybody else who was up there, but most of the people who were up there felt a necessity on some level or another to think that what was going on in front of us was okay in the name of broad-mindedness. I believe in God, you don't, well, you know, to each his own, without any sense of how profoundly detrimental to the human spirit what was going on truly was. Interestingly, somebody sent me an article which appeared in some major news publication about the extraordinary rise in suicide among people who were born after 1945, not just baby boomers, but everybody born after 1945, how the suicide rates are just increasing and increasing, and you're more likely to die from suicide than from being killed on the road. Of course, you're not, because it's not like you, it's not like it's a germ that you're going to catch. But to a certain extent, I have to say actually that it is. Because what's been happening in these last 70-some years is there's been a systematic undermining of meaning in life. And a systematic undermining of a belief in anything greater than the pleasure of my ego. And if my ego is not having pleasure, then what's the point? And the human spirit is not made like that. You know, hope is that which we live for, and joy is that which we live for, and we must understand the source of that. And the more systematically the secret of where happiness lies is taken away from people, and the more the problems are presented as insurmountable. I remember some little child once speaking at 9 or 10 years old. This was all about the ecology of the planet, and we feel we're doing such a good thing with these kids by telling them that the planet is a total mess. You know, the debts of the country are overwhelming, the governments are losing their mind, and guess what? You get to solve it. We've created it, we have no solutions, but now you little kids get to fix it. And I remember some little kid just with horror, you know, how can a child imagine how they can solve this problem? I know, and this is not even remotely humorous, it was intensely painful. There is a kind of epidemic of suicide sometimes, especially among teenagers. And we had a little mini epidemic in our local schools here. And about 5 children took their lives, and it was just horrifying for everyone involved. So they were having a local meeting, and Gary, being a middle school teacher, thought, well, maybe I could go to help. But there was a rule at the meeting, and I'm not kidding. Nobody could talk about God at the meeting. That solution could not be presented. Government, sectarianism, who knows? I mean, what was the point of going? This is the problem. The problem is that we're so concerned about the form of religion, we've forgotten the spirit of it, and we don't understand what it means to take away from children the meaning of life. Now, back to my experience with the atheists. We're up on this shelf, and there were several liberal Christians who were being extremely accommodating to the atheists. And I found myself sitting next to a man who was having a second career after having been an electrical engineer in Silicon Valley. He decided that he wanted to give his life to Christ instead, and he became ordained as a minister in a very Bible-based spiritual path. I think that's how they phrase it for themselves. If he and I had actually discussed theology, I do not think he would have thought as well of me as he did, because we were the only two people in that room who seemed to understand the reality of what was going on around us. And it wasn't like we had a long conversation, but it was sort of, we looked into each other's eyes and we looked around the room like this, especially when this black-haired fellow came striding out there in his black suits. And I mean, we were like children. We just sort of shrank back. I mean, we didn't cling to each other, but in every way we were sort of leaning into one another and leaning away from the people around us. And just kind of, we would whisper encouraging things to one another. And then he spoke boldly and forcefully for the necessity for God, and so did I. But it was quite a moment. And all the superficial differences of theology and practice and so on absolutely dissolved in the unity of realizing that this man had an inner life and I had an inner life. And no matter where we went on Sundays and how we preached it, not all of that was just such a thin facade over that inner fact. And in our Bible reading today, how best should we worship? We should worship any way that brings God to us. But merely by going and doing and saying and acting, if God doesn't really come to us, we haven't really worshiped at all. How shall I worship thee, Lord my God, with every breath I breathe? That's a chant that Swamiji wrote in the last few years. Because if we're not worshiping with every breath, we're not really worshiping. We're entertaining ourselves. And better to entertain ourselves in an uplifting way But it's really not worship unless there is an actual experience in it. Just yesterday, David and I decided that the car that I've been driving for the last whatever many years is, you know, way up into double digits in its age. So we decided it was time to replace it, and we went down to one of the local car lots and came home with a new car. Buying a new car just takes forever, just forever. And you're also, you're just handed from this man to that man to this man to that man, just this long succession of people who each have some individual part of this process of eventually giving you a car. And then sometimes they're mutually interchangeable and one of them disappears and another one comes. And because of the area that we live in, we were having a little mini United Nations. We were going from Iran to China to the Philippines, and all these different people. It was immensely entertaining. For some reason, I was just, we were both in the bov. We were just, you know, just waiting just to see what would happen next. And then we'd sit at the desk in front of someone trying to sell us the extra chrome wheels or whatever it was. You know, we just watch and let the whole thing happen and finally drove the car home. But at which point I promptly locked, you know, they give you these keys that have big brains in them. So they give you two keys with brains and they give you one key without a brain so that if you ever have to have your car parked by a valet, they call it a valet key, so that he can turn on the motor. But as soon as he turns on the motor, he immediately disables access to the trunk. This becomes relevant because within the first 45 minutes of owning the car, I locked both the keys with the brains in the trunk. Brilliantly picked up the valet key and immediately disabled my access to the trunk. I called the company. I guess what? Feel free to laugh, and then, which of course they did. And they said, no, this is not the worst we've ever heard, don't worry. But in the end of all of this, the last man who came in front of us in this, what turned out to be almost a 6-hour experience, during which the Giants hit a home run. I mean, there was lots of things happening, the huge television screen, and the Giants hit a home run and won the game. And so the auto shop changes into a sports arena briefly, and it was life at its best. But the last man, he asked us what we do, and David said, ministers, we're ministers, which he immediately took as Christian, because I don't think it crossed his mind that there was an alternative. He asked us the name of our church. We said, Ananda Church of Self-Realization. He then told us several stories about churches he'd been involved with, all had bad names that they had to change because nobody knew what they really were. So then he was just picking it all up from his own string. But he was an absolute pleasure. It's the only thing I can say about him. So the last hour was the best hour. And it wasn't like we sat around and talked about the Bible or anything like that. But you could see that this man loved God. He was a happy man, and he loved God. And he loved God deeply and truly and completely. You know, we had a little competition who'd been married longer, who was happier in their marriage. But it was just like all of it was based on the fact that he knew how to worship. He really knew how to worship, and he knew that worship was joy. And in fact, we talked about meditation. Because I said our church is based on meditation. I was sort of trying to go somewhere, see where we would go. And he said that he meditates. And then he talked about how one of his friends says he only meditates on the golf course and some other unlikely place. And this man was shaking his head. No, that's not real meditation. I just said, you've got to have God in there. It's not real meditation. But that's all that really matters. Now, Jesus did say, where two or more are gathered together, there am I in the midst of them. He wasn't necessarily and only saying, because it's individual, therefore you must always be alone. Because that's not human nature. Most of us, when we're left too much on our own, our energy gradually kind of winds down, doesn't it? When I used to teach the Meditation 1 classes regularly, everybody would be so enthusiastic about the people who were still attending the class were so enthusiastic about meditation. The attrition rate had also had its due. But by the time we got to the last class, out of 1,000, one seeks God. But out of 1,000 who seek, the Bhagavad Gita said, only one finds him. Master said, I love this. Our percentage is higher. That's what he says. Because this is a special dispensation, Kriya Yoga, and this path of self-realization. But nonetheless, many people who start with enthusiasm don't last. Something happens. What happens? You don't think you're ever going to stop. How could you imagine it? Becomes so meaningful, so powerful. And I would always try to give people the reasons why they will stop. I'll summarize a few of them that are not entirely relevant. Interestingly, one of the reasons people stop following the spiritual path, whether it's specifically meditation or the whole story, is ironic. It's because it begins to work. It actually begins to change you. And it begins to make whatever comfortable reality you are already in not so comfortable anymore. Maybe other people have noticed that you're a little different. You might not, you know, order the chicken. Now you order the broccoli. You know, maybe you're not taking the beer. You're just taking sparkling water. You know, things begin to happen. Or they notice that you don't get as frenzied when the Giants hit the home run. You know, just you begin to change. And even though one wanted to change, still, changes sometimes makes us uncomfortable, so we try to run back. Or our awareness increases. And the thing is, if you're sort of at the bottom of the hill, you don't really know what the valley on the other side looks like. You can't really see as much of a perspective on either the world or yourself. You climb to the top of the hill, and all of a sudden you can look down at these valleys and see what's going on, and that's not always a cheery thought. I remember a woman friend, it was from the spiritual path. She was one of the most moody people I ever knew. Very good heart, very sweet person, but my, my, you never knew from one day to the next who she might be. And she gradually began, and she said it to me this way, sort of ruefully, I never knew that I was moody. Like, it's like saying, I didn't know I had a nose. How could you not have known that? But she didn't. And when you begin to find out, you know, who you are, what you have to work with, what your deep-seated attitudes are, sometimes, again, oh, just let's just shut that window. That'll solve the problem. I'll just reduce my awareness. I'll go back to my pleasant state of denial and see how happy I can be there again. But another reason why people don't stay with the spiritual path is they don't feed themselves with satsang. Satsang, the company of other truth seekers. They don't feed themselves with inspiration. We just come in, as people often say, and get Kriya, which is how the phrase actually is. We take Kriya initiation. Oh, I'm going to go and get Kriya. It's like I'm going to go to Macy's and pick out a new jacket. You know, I'll go to Costco and get some organic carrots. I'm going to go get Kriya like this. We don't understand that it's not something that you can just put in a box. Your meditation practice, your initiation, your relationship with God. How shall I worship thee? With every breath that I breathe. But when the world is like the world we live in right now, why did Master, when he was living, emphasize so strongly the need for communities? Why did Swami Kriyananda dedicate his life as his personal commitment to his guru to found communities, and then after the first community was founded, to send us, people like David and myself and many of you all, to make these communities happen, these physical communities of residence and these communities of spirit, like the community that we have here? Because this is a hostile environment. I mean, it's not hostile in that people are arresting us, thank God. Maybe they will someday. Many, many, many people have had to face that terrifying choice of having armed people come into your church and try to take it away from you. God willing, that will never happen to us, but who knows? Being Jewish, I'm always aware of that possibility of religious persecution, but it's hostile. Well, we just spent yesterday afternoon at the auto place. You know, and I need a new car, and I'm really glad they're selling one and they're making such nice ones. And most of the people we dealt with were very, very nice. I'll never forget the first car in my life that I ever bought, which was back when I was about 19 years old. And at that time, I was working with the cash economy, and I had actually physical money to buy the car. Very odd, real, actual, like $100 bills. car we bought was not expensive, like maybe a couple of thousand dollars, but that was like the end of the 60s, so it was a lot more. We worked with this man. Talk about awareness or the opposite. He was barely conscious. He never took his dark sunglasses off the entire time. And he talked out of the middle of his mouth. I still remember this man. It was like he just didn't even want to come out enough to really talk to us. So he just sort of projected his words in the middle of his mouth so he didn't have to use his face. So he just had sunglasses and this kind of inert face. And we bought this, whatever we were buying at the time. And then it came time to pay for it. And because we were operating on a cash economy, we pulled out the money. When he saw the money, literally, when he saw the money, it's like he became sentient all of a sudden. He pulled off his sunglasses. He began to use his whole face as he took the money. And it just, you know, this was, what, 40 years ago? And I can still just vividly see the transition that took place. Extreme, utterly extreme. I mean, I'm not talking about everybody. But when you walk out from here and walk down the street, how many people are really trying to have an experience of God in whatever form? Very few. So we have to bring our hearts together. We have to breathe together. We have to pray together. We have to serve together. We have to hold each other's hands, just like that minister and I were hunched together, just bringing a unity of hearts, because in that unity is the strength that we need. Don't think for a minute that God, that the upward moving force is the only force on the planet. Someone wrote recently, and I thought it was so aptly put, the nature of this planet is such that there is a certain equilibrium between light and darkness, which is cosmically ordained because of the yuga we're in and the planet we're on, and the light will rise to a certain extent, but as soon as it reaches a certain point, then the darkness has to rise also. Now, as individual souls, we are not bound by that equilibrium. The individual soul can become perfect, pure light. But the environment we've chosen to live in could be better. Let's just put it like that. For some reason, we thought to incarnate now on planet Earth at this point, we thought it was a good idea at the time. Who knows why? But now that we're here, we have to be very realistic about where we are. And we have to be very realistic about the forces that are going to try to dislodge us from that constant, deep remembrance. And I don't just mean your general commitment. I mean your every breath commitment. Where does God live? God lives within. And we celebrate him in the way that we celebrate him together, because in that celebration, we feel him more deeply within. And when we feel him deeply within, you see, nothing can touch us. It's the portable paradise, one of Master's beautiful phrases. You carry within you a portable paradise. But we have to beat a very solid trail into that portable paradise. Every day, every problem, every unsettled moment, every instant of boredom, it can all be solved by just retreating back into that portable paradise. Then you can go everywhere. You can spend 6 hours at the automobile dealer. And just for some reason, if that reality is within you, you see the world becomes the same everywhere. You can feel very close attunement with others who love God in forms so different than our own, because we retreat from all that external and feel him in our heart. You know, what security and what joy. God bless you.